Hi, this is Alan Chartok, delighted, and I mean that, to be in conversation today with Dr. Mariko Silver, president of Bennington College in Bennington, Vermont. Dr. Silver took office as president of Bennington College July 1st, 2013. Prior to her appointment, Dr. Silver was a senior advisor to the president of Arizona State University, ASU. She previously held roles in the Obama administration, in the administration of Arizona's governor, Janet Napolitano, and at Columbia University. Silver served in the Obama administration as acting assistant secretary for international affairs and deputy assistant secretary for international policy of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, where she spearheaded the creation of the first department-wide international strategy, managed the department's international engagements, and co-developed a global initiative to enhance aviation security. Prior to that, she served as policy advisor to Arizona Governor Janet Napolitano with responsibility for the state's public and private universities, community colleges, and vocational institutions, the Arizona Department of Commerce and Science Foundation Arizona. In these capacities, she has worked with multiple communities and constituencies around the world and very close to home. In the office of the Executive Vice Provost, in the office of the Executive Vice Provost of Columbia University, Silver co-developed a multi-institution research response to the events of 9/11 and helped establish the International Innovation Initiative. She has also worked in London, UK, Bangkok, Thailand, and at the United Nations headquarters in New York City. Silver sits on the board of MassMoCA, is serving a three-year term on the Commission on Institutions of Higher Education of the New England Association of Schools and Colleges, and also serves on the Climate Leadership Steering Committee of Second Nature. She has in the past served on the boards of the Humanity in Action Foundation, Planned Parenthood of Arizona, and the Arizona Commission on the Arts, and is a member of the American Association of Geographers and a former term member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Silver holds a BA in History from Yale University, an MSc in Science and Technology Policy from the University of Sussex, UK, and a PhD in Economic Geography from the University of California at Los Angeles, UCLA. Silver is married to musician Tom Lubay and is mother of two children. We'll talk with Bennington College President Dr. Mariko Silver about all of this and much more. But first, Dr. Silver, welcome to WAMC. We've been trying to get you here. You are a brilliant star in the academic constellation around our area. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for the kind words.
Well, they're deserved. Let me start at the beginning. Who are you? Where were you born? Who are your parents? What's the deal?
All right. Well, I was born in New York City in the Eleanor Roosevelt wing of New York Hospital. My mother is Japanese American. I'm fourth generation. My father is Jewish American. I'm fourth generation on that side, too. They met in New York when they were both working in television and film. And then I was born in the Eleanor Roosevelt wing. I grew up in New York City until I was 15. And then I moved to L.A., finished high school there, moved back, as you said, to the East Coast for Yale. And the rest, I think you ably introduced.
No wonder you majored in geography. You're all over the place.
Yes.
So what were you like as a kid?
Well, you'd probably have to ask my mother to get a real answer, but I grew up in a very adult-centered world, as lots of New York kids do, I think. Lots of dinner table conversation about all kinds of things, politics, economics, ethics, religion. Very much a New York dinner table upbringing, New York City dinner table upbringing.
Private school?
I did go to private school.
Which go?
Where do you want to start? I went to Walden for preschool, which no longer exists.
I know it well.
Do you know it?
Well, yes. My twin brother Lewis and I played many Walden dances. We had
really?
A group, the Satellites for Music Out of This World.
Yeah. Wow.
But way before you were coming out.
Yeah, so I went to Walden for preschool, and then I went to Columbia Grammar, which is on the Upper West Side.
Around the corner.
Did you really?
Yeah.
And then I went to Ethical Culture.
Yeah.
Which you probably also know quite well.
I do.
On Central Park West. And then I went to Fieldston for middle school and the first part of high school.
Wow. So you really got to the creme de la creme of private schools in New York.
I was very fortunate.
What do you think about private versus public education?
Well, I am about to send my little kids to school. I intend to send them to public school. I think in part it depends on where you live. Depending on where you live, you have a different set of options, in addition to obviously your socioeconomic state. At that time in the 70s, as you probably well know, in New York City, the public schools in New York City were not then what they are now. If I were living in New York City now, I think there's a good chance I'd send my kids to public school. But I also think if you have the option, you have to look at who your kids are. Right. Different kids need different things. That said, from a political point of view, I am a very strong supporter of public schools. I think there's a lot we can do to enhance our public schools. And I'm certainly paying attention to that where I am now in Bennington, Vermont.
Let me go back to your father for a minute.
Yes.
What did he do? He worked.
He was a documentary filmmaker. He made films largely about artists, which you can imagine didn't make him very much money. So he also made trailers for movies, you know, those previews that you see when you go and you sit down before the real movie starts.
And your mom?
My mother worked in public television for about 30 years.
Wow.
And then she worked for the Nathan Cummings Foundation. She also worked for the Metropolitan Museum of Art and the Getty Trust, running a program called the Program for Art on Film, creating films about art. So you can see a little theme there. And then she worked for, I think, about 12 years at the Rockefeller Foundation, overseeing their arts and culture portfolio. And from there, she actually became the number two person at the National Endowment for the Arts. She was the deputy chair and then became the acting chair.
Is she still with us?
She is still. My father died in 2008, but my mother is still alive and well and living in New York City.
Have you asked her about President Trump's the leak that we're hearing that he wants to get rid of the National Foundations of Humanities and also Arts?
We certainly have talked about it. Obviously, she's not pleased. She is a strong believer, as am I, in public support for the arts, for the humanities, for public radio, for public television. So none of us in our family are very happy about that.
How'd you get the job?
This job?
Yeah.
Well, I did a bang-up job in the interview, obviously.
I can tell that just from talking to you now. Yeah.
No, I'm joking. I'm not. Thank you. I had known about Bennington for a long time. I have many friends who went to Bennington. And when I heard that the Bennington presidency was open after 25 years, I was very intrigued. As you said in the introduction, before this, I had worked at Arizona State University, the largest public university in the country, very different in many ways from Bennington. And yet, the thing that joins them in my mind is that they are both incredibly innovative and open. They are open to new ideas and new ways of doing the work of education.
So what was the interview like when they brought you in? Do you remember a tough question that you got asked?
Well, I certainly got asked about how I would translate my experience at a big public to a small private institution. But as I said, really, that's about philosophy, and it's about a way of thinking about institutions and what higher education is for, and the role of higher education both as a steady hand, but also as a place for experimentation and a place that needs to move as the world moves.
How'd you answer the obvious question about how are you going to support this place?
Well, every president of any college, university, public or private, knows that fundraising is part of the job. And what I talked about with the board and with the search committee is that though I didn't come in to Bennington with the kind of extensive individual one-on-one fundraising experience that some people do come to these jobs with, particularly if they've been a president somewhere else. But I did come in with a lot of experience talking to people about ideas and the connection between investing financially in those ideas and making them come to fruition.
So have you done some? Can you report to us that you have been on the hustings trying to get some money out of people?
Of course. Of course. I can't imagine you've ever had a college university president in this seat who isn't raising money.
So how does that go? I mean, what are the rules? What can you teach me about raising, about raising money?
Well, I would say a couple of things. Obviously, as you well know, I listen to you on the radio. You have to articulate the case, but you also have to make it gratifying and even a joy for people. Ideally, giving is a joy because you're giving to something that you care about, something that you love, or you're giving to make something that you care about happen, to make something that you love happen. And there I'm talking about individual giving, engaging with individual people who have money to invest in things that they care about. But of course, we also raise money from foundations. We have a significant grant from the Mellon Foundation to do some real roll-up-your-sleeves work on advising and curriculum. And in that case, you're writing a grant proposal, and you are convincing them that your idea, your interest is relevant, of course, to you and your institution, but also to the wider world.
Now, Bennington is fairly famous.
We like to think so.
Well, it is. I had girlfriends who went to Bennington you know, back in the day, and they were dance majors, and it was regarded as one of those places. I was a Fire Island kid where, you know, it was right at the top of those places like Oberlin and, you know, that people wanted to go to. But it was never the best funded of institutions. Has that changed, or is that still a major struggle?
You are quite correct about that. First of all, if you look around and look at the schools that were initially women's colleges, sure, they tend to be less well-funded than the ones that were initially men's colleges. Of course, there are some current and former women's colleges that are very well-funded, but even if you compare them to their otherwise equivalent peers, sure, that were originally men's colleges, they're not as well-funded. So that is something that we always are dealing with, and I'm sure if you had the president of, let's say, Vassar or Bryn Mawr in the seat, they might tell you the same. That said, Bennington was founded during the Depression. So we were behind in the beginning, if you catch my drift, in terms of fundraising. We started fundraising in a moment when there weren't a lot of funds to be had. Many schools, including my alma mater, are founded with an initial gift from a wealthy person, and then the institution bears that person's name. That did not happen in Bennington's case. And, you know, really what colleges and universities rely on over long periods of time is compound interest.
Right, so certainly. Let me ask you this, Dr. Silver. What if somebody walked in and said, here's $1 billion to change the name of this institution from Bennington to, you know, Coke or something like that? I mean,
for example.
For example, would you do it?
Well,
I think $1 billion?
It depends. Well, A, if they walked in here and they had $1 billion, I imagine I'd have to fight you tooth and nail for it. So let's start there. But I think it would depend on what they wanted to do with it. So I think there's the name.
Nothing more than just putting their name on it.
All right. Well, I think there's a name. People focus on the name, but you have to look at whether there are strings attached to the money. If they just wanted to put their name on it, it would depend on who they are. And I think we'd have to have a real conversation with alumni, because alumni are very dedicated to the place. But there are colleges and universities that have done that, and I think you have to make the case for it. I don't think you can just do it just because the money appears.
Your grandparents, right, were put into camps.
On my mother's side, yes. Actually, my mother was. She was a child. My mother was, my uncle was, and my grandmother was.
So what do you think, you know, in terms of a blot on our history?
It's certainly a blot on our history. I don't know if you noticed, but Korematsu was the Google Doodle.
I know the case well.
Yes, it was his birthday, and he was the image that, if you go to the Google search page, it was a drawing of him. And it is certainly a blot on our history, too, that the precedent hasn't been overturned. And you heard it in the campaign, people saying, well, that was a good precedent for how we can round people up. It is absolutely a blot on our history. And frankly, I think not enough people understand both, A, that it happened at all, that American citizens were interned by our government. My mother was born here. Her mother was born here. Of course, my uncle, too, was born here. They were born here. They were American citizens, and they were interned.
How has that affected your political views?
My political views. Well, what I can tell you is I don't remember a time, even as a child, when I didn't know that that had happened. Now, I'm sure that my mother was not telling me that story to, you know, put me to bed when I was an infant, but I don't remember a time when I didn't know that that had happened to my family. And it certainly affected my sense of justice and what we, I'm sure I didn't have this term then, but what we now call social justice, my sense that people see people who look different from themselves, from their families, people see them differently, and I don't just mean how they look, right? That people are perhaps too quick, or I would say definitely too quick, to jump to a position of suspicion about people who don't look like them. So I knew that very early on. How it's affected my psychology, you can talk to my mother or mental health professional, but in terms of how it's affected my politics, and of course, being a mixed race person myself, that's in the mix, if you will, too. And my father's family is Jewish. He was third generation, and so had been here, and we don't have family, for example, who were in Europe during the Holocaust, but certainly came here because of persecution of Jews in Europe.
The Muslim ban, if you want to put it that way, which has been described by some, President Trump announced that he made it clear what his feelings about Muslims were and coming into the country during the campaign. Now he says it's geographic, it's not against this particular religion. I don't happen to believe him, but I think what he said is probably what he's feeling. But does this come into play with what your family went through?
Well, I would say a couple things. First of all, it affects us directly at Bennington College. We have students who might be affected by this ban. So regardless of my own personal history, that shapes my views about the executive order. I believe and have said publicly that it goes against our values, and it actually goes against our goals. It goes against our goals in higher education. It's important, of course, to say that it goes against our values, but I think it's important to remember that part of what we are trying to do and what we've been asked to do by Americans is to educate students, to educate, in our case, largely 18 to 25-year-olds, 17 to 25-year-olds, about the world. And the best way to understand about the world is to meet people and talk to people who have different experiences from you. And if what we decide to do as a country is cocoon up and not talk to people who have different experiences than we do, we are doing the next generation a disservice of astronomical proportions. The knock-on effects of that, the ripple effect of that, I think cannot be quantified because they are so massive and so multivalent. And we need to think seriously about what it is we are trying to accomplish.
We are talking to Dr. Mariko Silver, president of Bennington College. I don't want you to think I'm provocative in any way.
Never.
But I had this girlfriend years and years ago who did not graduate from Bennington. And I said, how come you didn't graduate from Bennington? And she said, somewhat cryptically to me, who didn't really understand it, if you've graduated from Bennington, you've missed the point of the education. And I wonder whether that doesn't get to some of the counterculture aspects of the institution.
There's certainly some of that. And I will say publicly that I do not know how old you are.
75.
All right.
Old.
So
very old.
Some of that, of course, has to do with the era. That was an era in which not as many women were regularly graduating from any institution, and they were often getting married and leaving. So I can't speak
she
to
did.
Your particular...
She did not get married
All right.
and leave. But she was a sort of counterculture
yes.
person.
So the counterculture piece, I think, is real. Although in this day and age, you have to ask, what is the culture we are countering. But in that era, I think it's certainly true. It's a place that strongly encourages people to think for themselves.
Exactly. And that hasn't changed, right?
That has not changed. Every student, we have no majors. Every student.
How does that work with no majors?
How does it work? It's very high touch, if you will. So we spend a lot of time talking to students about what it is they want to do. Every student has something that we call the plan. Right. So in their second year at Bennington, they propose a plan. They sit with a committee of faculty members, sort of like a graduate dissertation committee, but not quite so adversarial, we hope. And they work through their idea. They, of course, also have a faculty advisor, and we have staff advising. And so they are selecting their courses with an eye towards a question. What is the thing that interests you? What is the intellectual hook for you? And or what is it that you want to do with your life? Now, I don't expect every 17-year-old to be able to answer the question, what do you want to do with your life? Or certainly to answer it definitively. But we give them an opportunity to try on and explore multiple pathways. And we do this in part through the plan, though at some point they do have to decide, this is the question I'm going to explore. This is how I'm going to explore it. And then we advise them about what courses to take to make sure that they are getting a multifaceted view of their question and not just reinforcing whatever preconceived ideas they have about it. If they want to study abroad, we often work with them. Or rather, if they want to study abroad, we always work with them to help them find a program that's going to really expand the horizons of their plan, their thinking, the way that they frame a question. These are all skills, as you well know, that people need out in the world. And I think the vast majority of traditional higher education doesn't put as much emphasis as they ought on this. Doesn't mean they don't do it, but they don't make it the center of what they do. We also, just to add one more thing, we also encourage students to do this because every year, every student, every year, goes out for 7 weeks in the winter and works in the world. So as soon as you land as a freshman, you have to find a job that will start for you in January and run through January and February.
Is that hard to do? I mean, I started a lot of internships in my life, the first in the state legislature here and the Legislative Gazette program and the rest. But is it hard to find? I mean, you have people, some of whom are well-heeled. Is it easier for somebody who's well-connected to get one of those outside jobs than it is for somebody who has nothing?
Of course it is. But we also have a fieldwork term office.
I see.
And we have a support infrastructure. We have fieldwork term advisors. We have a grant program internally to help those who may land a terrific internship, but it's unpaid, or they may land a terrific internship and it's paid, but they can't afford to live in the city where it is.
or it's paid and it's not a good job.
Yes. And, you know, there is something to be said for that, too.
Yeah. Hey, I'm a lifelong academic. I've been in trenches for a long, long time. Being the president of a college is not an easy job. I mean, you've got to decide on things like tenure, right, in the end. And there's always some faculty members, especially because you recruit interesting people, who'll give presidents of colleges a hard time. So how do you cope with all that?
Well, I'd say first, I mean, we don't want everyone to agree. What kind of intellectual environment is that if everyone agrees? Now, I'm saying this to the person who's on the roundtable on WAMC, so I know you don't believe necessarily in creating a group of people who all agree. In order to foster intellectual development, in order to seek truth, in order to build the minds of the future, and also to discover new ways of thinking, you have to have people who don't agree. So overseeing, if you will, or trying to shepherd, perhaps that's better, trying to shepherd a community of people who have very different views, that is absolutely part of the job of a college president, but it's also part of the excitement and part of the fun.
But certainly there are days you go home to your husband with your head in your hand and say, my God, let me tell you what this SOB did to me today, don't you?
I would be lying if I said no. However, I always try to take the at least medium, if not long, view of what it is that we're trying to accomplish. And one of the things that I say to students all the time is I want them to learn not just how to survive in the world as they find it, but to make the world as they want it to be. So I keep in my mind's eye that as the goal of the institution in many ways. And in order to do that as an institution, I, as a leader, have to keep that in my mind's eye and keep that as one of my goals.
Do you have to come up with new approaches to what the college will do? In other words, in my day, everybody thought of Bennington as a, you know, sort of a little bit of counterculture, a great place, a great dance program. But images change and needs change. And I guess the leader has to try to figure out where to go.
Of course we do. And I think it's incredibly important to be looking at the landscape, not just of the rest of higher ed, but also K-12, and to be looking at the broader global landscape and see what we think students are going to need in order to, as I said, not just survive in the world as they find it, but to make the world as they want it to be.
So how do you do in terms of scholarship? In order to keep that balance you were talking about, do you have to find some money to put some people in the mix who couldn't afford it?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. We spend between $15 and $18 million every year on financial aid.
Wow.
And that's all donor supported.
And what does it cost now if you're just going to the college? Is it $50,000, $60,000?
If you're all in, room, all in, board, yeah, everything, and not all of our students live on campus, though the vast majority of them do, then you're looking at something in the neighborhood of $60,000, which puts us, yes,
yeah, okay,
which puts us, frankly, at the below the top 50 most expensive.
Really?
Yes, it does.
They're more than that now?
I'm sorry to say.
That's extraordinary. Yes. So what about that? I mean, that's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money. I would say, as you can tell from my, if you can do in the quick back of the envelope math there, not all of our students pay the full amount.
Sure.
The vast majority of our students don't pay the full amount.
Sure.
And we are supported by donors to help them through. But even at paying the full amount, it doesn't nearly cover the cost. So it's a bit of a conundrum, and I'm sure you've heard of Baumol's cost disease and other economic theories about this, that anything that is high human interaction and requires a high in human interaction is expensive.
Is your faculty paid well?
They are paid on par with our peers. 2 years ago, we did a study of our peers and where our faculty salaries sit in relation to our peers. We have a little bit of work to do on what's called compression. So people who were hired a long time ago and have moved up at a regular steady pace in terms of their salary. But you hire new people in, and when you hire new people in, you're paying them starting at a higher rate and so on and so forth. So the people who have been there for a long time have been compressed, and we've been working on that.
Interesting. What about tenure? I mentioned that before. How do you guys conceive of tenure? You know, there's this old thing about people who stay too long, they turn over the notes, they use the same thing they've been using for years. Once somebody gets tenure, let's start there, how do you keep moving?
So we actually don't have traditional tenure.
What do you have?
At Bennington, we have long-term contracts. Almost more than 50% of our faculty are on long-term contracts and have been with us for well over 10 years.
Yes.
And we have a series of tiered contract lengths. And
First you get a shorter contract and then you get a longer contract.
That's right.
As time goes.
That's right. Which is, in terms of the rhythm of it, not all that different from a tenure track institution.
Right. How about this whole business of using people who become lecturers and, you know, maybe adjuncts for one course or two courses, which a lot of these colleges and universities are doing now? Do you do that?
We do some of that. Generally, that's driven by the particular desires of the visiting faculty member, right? So we might have somebody who's a professional doing another job, like you, who doesn't want to be a full-time faculty member, but would like to teach one or two courses a year or a course every other year or something like that. And then we have people who come in as sabbatical replacements and so forth.
Yeah. Well, I just want you to know that I did it. I did it for a long time. I was joint professor at two places and ended up doing television every night and running this place for a long time. And it damn near killed me. But, but yeah, I found that students who thought that you had been in the outside world and could do something to help them find where they were going were pretty attracted to those types of professors as opposed to only, you know, people who were academics.
And we have a lot of our full-time faculty who are also doing things out in the world. Right. In fact, all of them do. That's part of their requirement, if you will, is the work in the world, as we call it. But there are people who prefer, so for example, we have a faculty member who is a very well-known photographer. Her work is in the Museum of Modern Art in New York City. It's in the Centre Pompidou in Paris. And she wants to teach half the year and have half the year to be in her studio and out in the world. And so we've worked that out with her.
Do Bennington students ever fall in love with their professors?
Is no comment an appropriate answer to that? I cannot speak to the inner feelings of Bennington students. However, it is against the rules, and we have not seen in many years, to have a relationship between a faculty member and a student.
So if a faculty member and a student came into your office and said, we want to tell you, we couldn't help it, we're very sorry, but we've fallen in love, what would you say?
Well, first I would say to you, I did not expect this interview to go there. However,
that's why I like to do this interview.
However, we would say that that is against the rules. And depending on the situation, in other words, depending on how far along it was, it would either have to go in front of a judicial committee of peers, or it would be a cause for termination of the faculty member.
That's interesting because at SUNY, when I was there, one day there was a knock on the door and that exact situation happened and said, you're a colleague. We wanted you to know. And I said, fine, I have no problem with this. So you would disagree with that, right?
What year was that?
Oh, it was certainly 10 years ago.
Yeah, I would disagree with that. Now, I think in an institution where you have graduate students working with faculty members, some of those institutions have different rules around graduate students. Some of them do not. But overall, I would say the teacher-student relationship, in whatever form it is a power relationship.
Well, there's no question about that. Yeah, but things happen, don't they?
Not at Bennington, I hope.
Not at Bennington, you hope. Okay. So let me go from there and ask you about your background in geography.
Yes.
What do you bring to Bennington as a geographer?
Well, my PhD, as you mentioned, is in economic geography, which is really the exploration of economic activity across space. Why are some places economically successful and others aren't, so on and so forth. Why are certain industries clustered in particular places? And one of the things that I then bring to Bennington is a real genuine interest and some measure of expertise in economic development. And so, for example, we are, under my leadership, engaged directly with a number of other institutional leaders and private leaders in the town to redevelop the Putnam Hotel block, which is at the main intersection in the town of Bennington.
Huh. Well, but I've been fascinated over the years, done a lot of these interviews, and sometimes with geographers who redefine what geography is. When I went to school, you took a look at the states and you had to memorize them, and there were these things, these places. But the new geography is a little bit different. Can you tell us about that?
It is quite different. Obviously, there's still a map element. That is more on the environmental science side of geography, because geography is a broad umbrella, encompasses both the social science and the environmental physical science aspects. But it is very much focused on, in my case, the more social science approach. You know, why do people behave in particular places the way that they do?
Go a little further on.
All right. So, for example, I wrote my dissertation on how institutions in China, in particular in a place called Chengdu, China, which is in Western China, and in Ho Chi Minh City in Vietnam, known to many as Saigon, how in those two places the entry of multinational corporations changed the institutional fabric of those places, the way the government in those two places interacted with multinational corporations and the way they thought of their job and what the economic development implications of that might be.
Conclusion?
Conclusion that, in fact, the entry of a particular multinational corporations did change the way that in Chengdu I looked at economic development officers in the government, the way that they thought about what their job was, and how they learned, in a way, how to interact with multinational corporations. And I say that.
Were they walking a tightrope? In other words, you know, you have a communist, allegedly a communist ideology, and now you, in order to succeed, you got to bring in the multinationals, but you have to look over one shoulder and then the other shoulder, yes or no?
I don't know that I would characterize it quite that way. And there are certainly people who study economic development in China who would take that view and have taken that view. But I would say in particular, in what I was looking at, I was looking at the way a specific set of government employees was engaging with this multinational corporation. And there are a lot of different ways to think about, as you probably well know, to think about what is the job of government in attracting a company? What are you supposed to do every day to make that happen? And in a way, a lot of these folks who worked for the government were learning a multinational corporation's point of view about what that ought to look like. What did they need to do on everything from import-export regulations to land use regulations? Right? What were the expectations of multinational corporations? And in so doing, they changed the way their office was configured. They changed the way that they worked. So the next multinational corporation that comes in is going to meet a different government configuration than the first one that came.
Well, I'm fascinated by this. I really am. And I love the idea that because I'm older and I come out of the time when Vietnam was seen as a, you know, a block, a domino that would fall and then the world would fall and follow it. Turns out that wasn't true. And turns out you were in a great place to study that. So did you have to go? Did you have to be there?
I did. Yeah. I did. I had the opportunity to go. Absolutely.
And what was it like?
It's beautiful. And now it's been a few years since I was last there, but it's thriving. I mean, it's a riot of economic activity, but the government also still has a very strong role to play, differently perhaps in Hanoi than in Ho Chi Minh City, but it is, you definitely still feel the government presence.
But what about the Vietnamese view towards Americans?
Well, I would never attempt to speak for all Vietnamese.
Certainly not. But what did you see?
But what I will say is that in the work that I did with the government on education reform, particularly engineering education reform in Vietnam, one of the things that I saw is that there really needed to be what in social science speak is a boundary-spanning organization in order to enable certain kinds of Western ideas about education to come in. In other words, if American aid organization USAID came in and said, we think you Vietnamese Ministry of Education should do this, right? Or the embassy came in and said, we think you Vietnamese Ministry of Education should do this, that there might be a not so positive reaction. I don't know that it would be negative, but it might just be a nodding of heads. Whereas if, in our case, Arizona State University, a multinational corporation, and USAID came in together and said, here are some best practices, and we as Arizona State University, as the educational institution, were the messenger to say, here are some educational best practices that we'd like to work with you on, there was a receptivity there.
So give us some examples of these best practices.
So for example, there is an engineering school accrediting body, and there are requirements or recommendations about certain numbers of credit hours to be spent in various aspects of engineering. There are recommendations about, for example, project-based work, team-based work, things like that. So it was very much focused on the work of education, right? It was not focused on anything quote-unquote political in any way. But there is a real bureaucracy there. It's not as though one institution could just decide, okay, we're going to change our engineering curriculum now. It had to go all the way up through the Ministry of Education and then come all the way back down. And I know that they were thinking about the implications. If we let one university change their approach, what's going to happen to the rest of the universities? Of course, they're thinking about resource implications too, but thinking also about, you know, what happens to people who've been teaching a particular way for a very long time. Do they get replaced? Do they keep their jobs? And also thinking about the way that educational material was parceled out. So for example, there are requirements to study Ho Chi Minh thought. There are only so many hours in the day. If you want to graduate your students in a certain period of time with an engineering degree that is approved by the international accrediting body, then you might have to make some adjustments to the way that's taught.
Did they? I mean, you know, when you say Ho Chi Minh 101, you really can't do that if you want to do this, running this university well.
Well, I wouldn't put it that way. It's a question of how much time and what the requirements are. Let me give you another example. So if you have a certain kind of very testing-heavy-based curriculum and lecture-based curriculum, that's going to lead you to one approach in terms of the way you allocate your time. If you have a more project-based approach, that's going to lead you to another way of allocating your time. And there are real considerations, which I respect, about thinking about retraining faculty or understanding whether you have the right faculty to teach in this way. At the same time, this is the way the world is going, and so they had to make some tough decisions, I would imagine. I wasn't in those rooms, but some tough decisions about how to allocate resources in their system.
Just to be clear, when you were there, you did not, because we hear a lot of anecdotal stories, you did not feel tremendous hatred towards the American enemy?
No.
Interesting. Fascinating. Okay, so where you're going now at Bennington, I want to talk to you a little bit about women and a women's college.
Well, we're co-ed now.
Yeah, no, I know. Mm-hmm. But there's got to be a little tension, right, between the fact that you came from a women's college and that you're now co-ed. How is that working out?
I do know that there are some alums who regret that we went co-ed many years ago. But I think if you ask current students, they would say that it's quite fine and they're quite happy that it's co-ed.
Okay, so what are the disadvantages of ending single-sex education?
Well, I think embedded in your question, there are questions for a particular institution about the advantages and disadvantages of ending single-sex education in that particular institution in that context. And then there's a bigger question about single-sex education more broadly. I certainly believe my mother, my aunt, my mother-in-law are all Bryn Mawr grads. I'm a strong believer in women's education, certainly in single-sex women's education, to be sure. I have a feeling one of my children might eventually head that way, though they're 3 and 4. So, you know, you'll have to check back with me in a few years to find out if that prediction proves true. But I'm a big believer in it. But I don't think every institution has to do it.
So there's been a good deal of scholarship on this. We know that. And people standing up and saying, you know, girls are often, especially in the lower grades, deferential to boys. Is there any proof that that's happening at Bennington? Mm-hmm.
I would say no, not in my experience. Now, I'm not in every classroom in every moment, but I have found Bennington students to be quite ready to stand up for themselves for the most part.
Do you teach?
I do.
What do you teach?
This past year, I taught a tutorial on economic development in downtown Bennington, aligned with a project that I just described. And this year, I taught a course about the election, together with Noah Coburn, who's an anthropology faculty member who teaches about elections and transitioning democracies.
We're talking to Dr. Mariko Silver, president of Bennington College. So, doctor, let me ask you this. You exist in a political environment, as you've just said.
Well, we all do, don't we?
Yeah. I wanted to ask you a two-word question, okay? Bernie Sanders.
Well, there you is are. Is that a question?
That's Bernie Sanders, question mark. There you are, a geographer who certainly understands political geography. I've had Bernie Sanders on this radio station many, many times. And I remember the day we were talking, somebody's got to run, he said. I said, well, will you run? He said, we'll see. And that, I think, is the first time that we
got an inkling that that was going to happen.
That this was really going to happen.
You heard it here first.
Well, yeah. So I sort of wonder, what is it about Bernie Sanders, in your estimation, that made him so popular? And I'm going to give you a hint about where I'm going.
Right.
And that is there something in common with Donald Trump?
Well, I think one of the things that both research and I think human experience tells us is that people look for authenticity in people in leadership positions. That is increasingly true. It's very true of the quote unquote millennial generation and those who are coming up behind them, so-called Generation Z. And I think Bernie, in his inimitable way, exudes a certain kind of authenticity. He says what he thinks and he engages with people directly. And I think that is something that people really saw and felt in him and responded to.
So you've got 2 United States senators from Vermont.
Yes, we do.
And 1 congressman.
Yes, we do. I've met them all.
They're all great. So the question I have for you is, do you deal with them at Bennington? Do you have to deal with them?
have to makes it sound like I wouldn't ever want to. Right. We do deal with them. We work with them. We've talked to actually all of them about both our programs at Bennington, but also the economic development efforts in Bennington Town. Mm-hmm. I've talked with them directly. Also talked with them about a variety of issues that are on our minds as an institution and on the minds of our students. And most recently, as I mentioned at the beginning, we have students who are affected by this Trump's executive order on immigration, and they have been extraordinarily helpful and supportive, and I thank them for that.
So as an economic geographer, let me throw this one at you. Should WAMC take money from the federal government?
I'm not sure that the credential and the question quite line up, but I would say it depends on by what mechanism.
No. You have a corporation for public broadcasting.
Yes.
They say, okay, here's the pot. Here's your share. In our case, it's $400,000. And we have this corporation for public broadcasting that is the mechanism for doing that.
Yeah. So if you're talking about, I thought perhaps you were projecting into a future idea of how that might be,
a la
your $1 billion Coke question.
Well, I am. Is there something bad about taking money from the government? There is not.
No, I don't think there's something bad about taking money from the government. I wouldn't even put it in the taking category. I think that's perhaps the wrong verb. It is money that the taxpayers are investing in publicly available information.
And then what if they say, we're going to make rules that you can't express your opinion or you can't...
Well, that's another story entirely. And so far as I know, that's not happened.
No, that is happening.
Well,
go read the rules for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Mm-hmm.
So it does happen. So my feeling is that, you know, we do have this situation in America where we have a guy who is taking no prisoners. And would this radio station be better off saying, okay, take your money and, you know, basically shove it?
Well,
you didn't think this was going to go.
No, I didn't think this was going to go this way. And I will preface this by saying public radio is not my area of expertise. I think
no,
it would have to be
very smart.
I think it would be an interesting question for all of the different stations and affiliates to talk about together. I don't know how much value there is in one individual station saying we will no longer participate in this as a public program, public as in with funding from the government. I'm not sure that holds as much value. I think having a conversation among the public radio affiliates, is that the right word?
Yeah, the right word.
Thank you. Among the public radio affiliates about having a position about censorship. I'm sure there is one, but perhaps if it needs to be rethought in the current climate, I think that's a conversation absolutely worth having.
But what if you heard that, let's say, National Public Radio, for
mm-hmm.
example, was changing its orientation towards either news or whatever, based on who was sitting in the White House?
I would be very disappointed to hear that. I think that is a moment then for National Public Radio to decide, and I would hope that they would decide that they would not change their orientation based on who's in the White House.
Don't all organizations sooner or later become the tail wagging the dog? I mean, don't they at some point say, okay, the most important thing to us is staying alive. We want to stay alive, and therefore we'll do whatever is necessary in order to do that, and we'll come up with any kind of rationale we need to do that.
Well, of course, that's a human tendency, and
yes, it is.
Organizations are humans, and so perhaps that's inevitable, but there would be a certain orientation about that. But I think that's also why it's very important before the crisis moment, should an organization face a crisis moment, before that moment comes, to have conversations about values, principles, and to have those hopefully on an ongoing basis, depending on the type of organization. You may not know what the line is until you face it, but if you're squarely grounded in your values and principles, then you will know it when you see it.
So, Mariko Silva, what gets you angry?
Oh, other than when my children won't put their pants on in the morning.
How old are the kids now?
They're 3 and 4.
Wow.
So I'm sure any of your listeners who have 3 and 4-year-olds will relate to that.
Either that or as a grandchild, which
yes,
we do.
Yes,
3-year-old.
Yes. Boots are a whole other story.
But they are really terrific at that age, aren't they?
They are. They have a lot to say, and sometimes it's hilarious.
And what do you think about as a mother versus as a professional, as a president, an incredibly skilled president? What carries over from one to the other?
It's an interesting question. So I actually do think about that a lot. One of the things that I think spending time with young children, whether you're a parent or not, really reinforces is the value, and not just the value, but also the dynamics of human relationships, right? If you're engaged with a kid, you know, all of the extra layering and baggage that those of us who are older have and the kind of manipulation or whatever else comes into play mostly isn't there. And so you are really engaging with another human on a fundamentally human level. You're engaging, especially with toddlers in my case, people whose emotions are right up front and they're saying what they think because they don't know any other way, even when when it makes you mad. And that really makes me think, I think, differently about all kinds of relationships. And in fact, as I said, you know, organizations are configurations of humans. And as I say to our students, the institutions that govern the norms and values, as well as the hard and fast rules of your lives, are created by humans, which means they can be recreated by humans. They can be rethought by any human, including you.
What happens when a pain in the ass faculty member comes into your office and is completely off the wall? Can't you say you're going to a timeout?
No. Or I haven't had to yet.
But I love what you're saying, because there's a certain commonality in all human communication, whether you're 3 years old or whether
you're 50 years old. And I think sometimes we forget, this is also true, let's say, for the federal government, when we're engaging with, dealing with big institutions, that it's a whole bunch of human beings. And I think we forget that at our peril.
So, Dr. Mariko Silver, let me ask you this. What is it about a student at Bennington versus a student at the state university? Do you think these are all the same kids, or do you think there are different priorities? My hypothesis, you'll shoot it down, but my hypothesis is that a student at Bennington is probably less concerned about where their first dollar is going to come from after they graduate than a kid at the state university.
Well, I will shoot it down in that I will say certainly we have a wide range of socioeconomic capability incoming in our student body. So we fluctuate between 15% and 20% Pell eligible students. And for those of you who don't follow higher ed so closely, that's low income students from low income families. And we work to support them. And that's where that financial aid number comes from. The number percentage is surely higher at many of the state institutions. I know that from my work at Arizona State, and I'm sure it's true at the SUNY institutions as well. But
so
we
you don't
are very
see marked differences between the two sets of kids.
Not necessarily. In any particular SUNY campus, my guess is, again, not knowing the SUNY system as well, or certainly I can speak to the CUNY system. If you look at, for example, LaGuardia Community College or York, the percentage of students who don't have support at home, the percentage of students who are working while they're getting their degrees, the percentage of students who are from Pell-eligible families, much, much higher. Much, much higher. And it does change the culture of the place. So in that sense, it certainly is different.
But you do have a very, I think, terrific program of placing students and asking them to go out once a year for several weeks. Why is that so important?
Well, it's been part of we call it the fieldwork term. For your listeners who may remember Bennington from a number of years ago, it used to be called the non-resident term. And during fieldwork term, as I said, every student every year has to get a job, go out and do that work. And then they also have to, we have a structure for them to reflect on their work experience and really try to integrate what they've learned into their educational
experience. What's that structure? I used to make them write, you know, book reports, which prepared the book with what they were doing, and a weekly reaction and seminar paper to do that. But do you do that?
So we have a fieldwork term essay, but some students also can, if they get a grant from us, they also have to do a presentation about what they did and what they learned, because we also want them to hone their communication skills in multiple ways.
But if they're in Chicago.
When they come back. We also want them to see what others are doing.
Exactly.
Right? We're a community. So we have something called a fieldwork term night, and sometimes we have two, and students present, and you can walk around, and we'd love for you to come sometime. We walk around a building that we call the Advanced Center for the Advancement of Public Action, and they set up tables and they give presentations and they show the work that they did over fieldwork term.
Okay, but while the thing is going on,
yes,
somebody's in California, somebody's in Chicago, somebody's here or there in New York. Is there any way now that the electronic media, the new digital media can be used?
Yeah, so there are students who blog, for example, instead of writing the essay at the end, you have the option of blogging. And there are students who use every imaginable Instagram and everything else, every imaginable kind of social media to share what they're doing.
Do you find it's productive to have them do that?
We do find it's productive to have them do that. It depends on what they're doing. Some students can speak more publicly about the work that they're doing than others based on who their employer might be. We've been very fortunate also to have employers in your listening area, and we appreciate it. If there are employers who are interested in bringing on a fieldwork term student from Bennington, they can email fwt@bennington.edu. And we always are looking for more employers. And we find that the students learn an extraordinary amount, both about the working world and about themselves. So, for example, you and I both know that there's more to work than the job as it looks on paper. And you can tell students this until you're blue in the face. But for the vast majority of not just students, but people in general, you have to experience it to really know. So maybe you're a person who thinks you want to be a sole proprietor, right? You want to be a person who works on your own. And in fact, you find, oh my goodness, no, I really need interaction with other people to do the kind of work I want to do. Or you're a person who thinks you want to work in an office. That sounds great, sitting behind a desk. You go and have an experience doing that, and you think, oh my goodness gracious, that is not the thing for me.
What does the word engagement mean to you?
In terms of our students, it really means not just being physically present, but really connecting with ideas, connecting with ways of thinking, and connecting with each other so that you are broadening your sense of self, but also your sense of the world. In terms of working with employers, one of the things that's actually very alarming when you look at the data on millennials, Gallup did a poll 1 or 2 years ago that millennials are among the least engaged at work. And yet engagement at work is one of the greatest predictors of success, as I'm sure you can imagine well. One of the things that we're very proud of is that our students score very high on all kinds of measures of engagement at work, both when they are with us and after they graduate.
So give me that definition on engagement again.
Well, in the classroom, it's about connecting with ideas, connecting with other people, and developing thought together. In the work environment, it means caring about what you do. It means being committed to what you do. It means being stimulated by what you do. We've all had, I think, most of us anyway, have had jobs or at least projects where we were particularly engaged or not engaged.
So tell me why my granddaughter ought to go to Bennington.
How old is she?
She's not born yet.
Okay. All right. So we're projecting forward. Fair enough. Your granddaughter ought to come to Bennington because my guess is that your granddaughter is going to be someone who really wants to ferret out the truth around whatever it is that she's interested in, that she's going to have ideas and pursuits and a way of engaging critically with the world that will help her to push forward the ideas that she's interested in.
So how should the Shartok family, how should the Shartok family prepare to pay the fairly enormous amount of money that will probably be required of an upper middle class family? Should there be a college fund for the kids? What do you do?
Sure. I'm not a financial advisor, but I will say for my own kids, I have 529 plans and we have college savings accounts. I think it's the most important investment you can make in the future of your child and in the future of your family is investing in the education of, in your case, your grandchildren or your children. And I think you should think about it that way.
Does it ever break your heart when you see somebody who ought to come to the college who doesn't quite make the demographics that they need to do in order to get in because there just isn't enough money to go around to anybody?
It would break my heart, but we do everything we can to get that student in.
Well, we've had a wonderful hour with Dr. Mariko Silver, the president of Bennington College. I have to say, I do a lot of these, and I just think you're terrific.
Thank you very much.
I think you've done a great job explaining it all to us. And I thank you so much for coming all the way in and doing it. We'll be hoping to hear a lot more from you.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Shartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.